Chapter 3. Captive. So confident were the Rebu that if the Egyptians dug through their walls they could repel their assault, that they took but little heed to the huts established at the foot of the wall. This confidence proved their ruin. The Egyptians were thoroughly accustomed to mining operations, and were fully aware that were they to pierce the wall, the Rebu could at once overwhelm the small working parties. They therefore, after penetrating a considerable distance into the embankment, drove right and left, making an excavation of considerable size, the roof being supported by beams and planks hauled up at night. The number of those employed in the work was increased as fast as there was room for them, and there were, at the end of 24 hours, fully 200 men at work in the heart of the embankment at each point. The Egyptian king had ordered the chief of his engineers to have everything in readiness for the capture of the city by the end of the third day. Each night the numbers of workmen increased, while the excavations were carried in further and further. No picks were used, the earth being cut away with wide daggers. Absolute silence was enjoined among the workers, and they were thus enabled to extend their excavations close to the surface without the defenders having an idea of their proximity. The distance that they were from the inner face was ascertained by boring through at night-time with spears. By the end of the third day, the excavations had been carried so far that there was but a foot or so of earth remaining. Thus, at 20 points, the Egyptians were in readiness to burst through among the unsuspecting defenders. As soon as it was dark, the preparations for the assault began. Great numbers of stagings of vast length had been prepared, together with an immense number of broad and lofty ladders, which were brought forward noiselessly to the foot of the cliff. And great numbers of the Egyptians mounted before the alarm was given by those on the walls. The Egyptian army now advanced with shouts to the assault. The great stages were brought forward and placed against the cliff. The besieged had now rushed to defend the walls, and volleys of missiles of all sorts were poured down upon the Egyptians as they strove to mount the ladders and stages. No one thought of any possible danger from the little shelters lying at the foot of the wall, and the din was so great that the work of digging through the remaining wall of earth was unheard. The troops who had been specially told off to watch these points had joined their comrades on the walls, and none marked the stream of dark figures, which presently began to pour out from the embankment at 20 different points. At last, the besieged, whose hopes were rising as the Egyptians appeared to falter under the shower of missiles poured down, were startled by the sound of a trumpet in their rear. Rushing with cries of dismay to the back of the rampart, they saw dark bodies of footmen drawn up in regular order, and a rain of arrows was opened upon them. The Rebu rushed down to attack the foes who had gained a footing, they scarce knew how, in their fortress. But each of the Egyptian companies was 400 strong, composed of picked troops, and these, for a time, easily beat off the irregular attacks of the Rebu. Amusis and the other leaders of the Rebu strove to get their men into solid order, but the confusion was too great. In the meantime, the Egyptians outside had taken advantage of the diversion created by the attack within, and poured up their ladders and stagings in vast numbers. Some, dragging up ladders after them, planted them against the walls. Others poured through by the passages which had been dug, and these ascended the embankments from behind and fell upon the Rebu still defending the wall. Never did the tribesmen fight with greater bravery. But the completeness of the surprise, the number of the Egyptians who had established themselves in their rear, the constant pushing in of reinforcements both through and over the wall, rendered it impossible for them to retrieve their fortress. Upon the Egyptian side, everything had been carefully planned. One of the companies which first entered had made their way quietly along the foot of the wall, and were not noticed until they suddenly threw themselves upon the defenders of one of the gates. As soon as they had obtained possession of this, great fires were lighted, and a large body of Egyptian troops, headed by engineers carrying beams and planks, advanced. The gaps across the roadway were bridged over, and the Egyptians poured in at the gate. To the Ribu, it seemed as if their foes were springing from the very earth, and they began to break away and flee, some for their homes, some for the water face of the city, the only one which was open to them. The boats lying along the sand were quickly crowded with fugitives and pushed off from the shore. Those who arrived later found all means of escape gone. It was some hours before the conflict ceased, for the Egyptians too were confused with the darkness, and many desperate fights took place between different battalions before they discovered they were friends. At last the trumpet sounded the order for the troops to remain in the positions they occupied until daylight. As soon as morning broke, a vast crowd of women were seen advancing. As they neared the Egyptians, they threw themselves on the ground with loud cries for mercy. Some Egyptian officers advanced, and bade a score of the women follow them to the presence of the king. These threw themselves on their faces before the great monarch and implored mercy for themselves, their children, and the remnant of the men of the city. Thutmose was well satisfied. He had crushed the people who had inflicted defeats upon his predecessors. He had added to his own glory and to the renown of the Egyptian arms. When I fight with cowards, I have little mercy upon them. But when I fight with brave men, I treat them as brave men, the king said graciously. The Ribu are a valiant people. They fought bravely in the field, and they have bravely defended their walls. Therefore I grant life to all in the city, men, women, and children. Where is your king?
He died in the battle 4 days since, the women replied.
Where is your queen?
She drank poison last night, preferring to join her husband than to survive the capture of her city.
Thutmose now ordered the inhabitants to be taken out to the plain and kept there under guard. The town was then methodically searched, and everything of value brought together. The king set aside a certain portion of the golden vessels for the services of the temple. Some he chose for himself, and after presenting others to his generals, ordered the rest to be divided among the troops. He then ordered 100 captives, 50 young men and 50 maidens of the highest rank, to be selected to be taken to Egypt as slaves, and then fixed the tribute which the Ribu were in future to pay. The army then evacuated the city, and the inhabitants were permitted to return. The next day, messengers from the other Ribu towns brought offers of submission to the king, with promises to pay any tribute that he might lay upon them. The king, well satisfied with his success and anxious to return to Egypt, from which he had been absent nearly 2 years, replied graciously to the various deputations, informing them that he had already fixed the tribute that the nation was to pay annually, and ordered a contribution to be sent in at once by each city in proportion to its size. In a few days the required sums, partly in money, partly in vessels of gold, embroidered robes, and other articles of value, were brought in. When the full amount had been received, the camp was struck, and the army started on their long march back to Egypt, an officer of high rank being left as governor of the newly captured province with 10,000 men as a garrison. For Amuba, the news of the death of his mother had been a terrible blow, following as it did so closely upon the loss of his father and the overthrow of the nation. His mother had left a message for him.
You will doubtless, my son, be carried away captive into Egypt, but you may yet escape some day and rejoin your people, or may meet with some lot in which you may find contentment, or even happiness there. At any rate, bear patiently whatever may befall you, Remember always that your father was king of the Ribu, and whatever your station in life may be, try to be worthy of the rank to which you were born. There is no greater happiness on a throne than in a cottage. People make their own happiness, and one may be respected even though only a slave. May the gods protect you always.
Struck down with grief, Amuba was scarcely moved when the Egyptian officer appointed to make the selection chose him as one of the 50 men that were to be taken as slaves to Egypt. However, he felt it to be a comfort when he found that Jethro was also of the party set aside.
"I am not sorry that I have been chosen," Jethro said. "You and I, Prince, perhaps of all those chosen, will feel the least misery at the fate that has befallen us. Most of those here are leaving wives and children behind. Some of the youngest are still unmarried, but they have fathers and mothers from whom they will be separated. Therefore, let us not bemoan our lot, for it might have been worse, and our life in Egypt may not be wholly unbearable." Jethro and Amuba went among the rest of the captives, most of whom were prostrated with grief, and did their best to rouse them. "The Egyptians have seen that the Ribu are men in the field," Amuba said to some of them. "Let them see that we can also bear misfortune like men. They will have far more compassion upon us than if they see that we bemoan ourselves. We have a long and toilsome journey before us, and we shall need all our strength, and the hardship of our lot is as nothing to that of the women yonder. Let us therefore set them an example of courage and patience. Let us bear ourselves as men whose suffering is unmerited, who have been conquered but not disgraced, who are prepared to defy fate and not to succumb to it." Amuba's words had a great effect upon the captives. They regarded him with respect as the son of their late king, and his calmness and manly speech encouraged them to strive against their grief and to look their fate more hopefully in the face. It was a long and tedious journey. In the first city they entered, Amuba was astonished at the massive splendor of the buildings and at the signs of comfort and wealth which everywhere met his eye. The streets were thronged with people who, bending to the ground, shouted their acclamations as the king passed along and who gazed with interest at the long procession of captives. Most of all, he was surprised at the temples, with their long avenues of sphinxes, the gigantic figures representing the gods, the rows of massive pillars, the majesty and grandeur of the edifices themselves. "How were they built, Jethro?" he exclaimed over and again. "How were these massive stones placed in order? What tools could they have used to carve them out of the solid granite?" "It must have taken the strength of thousands of men to have transported even one of these strange figures, and although the people themselves may have aided in the work, you may be sure the slaves bore the brunt of it."
The journey was continued for another 3 weeks, and was the cause of constant surprises to the captives. The extraordinary fertility of the land especially struck them. The abundance and variety of the crops that everywhere met their eye seemed to them absolutely marvelous. Irrigation was not wholly unknown to the Ribu, but the enormous works for the purpose in Egypt, the massive embankments of the river, the network of canals and ditches, the order and method everywhere apparent, filled them with surprise and admiration. Amuba's wonder reached its climax when they arrived at Memphis. The wealth and contents of the city astonished the captives, but most of all were they surprised when they saw the enormous bulk of the pyramids rising a few miles from the town, and learned that these were tombs of the kings. At last, after another fortnight's traveling, a shout of joy from the army proclaimed that Thebes, the capital of Egypt, the goal of the long and weary march, was in view. Thebes stood on both sides of the Nile, As they neared the city, an enormous multitude poured out to welcome the king and the returning army. Shouts of enthusiasm were raised. The sound of trumpets and other musical instruments filled the air. Religious processions from the great temples moved with steady course through the dense crowd, which separated at once to allow the passage of the figures of the gods and the priests and attendants bearing their emblems. "Indeed, Jethro," Amuba exclaimed with enthusiasm. "What a wonderful people are these! What knowledge and power and magnificence! Why, my father's palace would be regarded as a mere hut in Thebes, and our temples, of which we thought so much, are pygmies by the side of these immense edifices." "All this is true enough, Amuba, and I do not say that I too am not filled with admiration. And yet you know the Ribu several times drove back their forces, and man for man are more than a match for their soldiers. Our people are taller than they by half a head. We have not so much luxury, nor did we want it."
"Perhaps so," Amuba assented. "But no one can say that the Egyptians are not brave, though I agree with you that physically they are not our equals. See how the people stare and point at us, Jethro. I should think they've never seen a race like ours with blue eyes and fair hair."
The surprise of the Egyptians was indeed great at the complexion of their captives, and the decoration of their walls has handed down in paintings which still remain the blue eyes and fair hair of the Ribu. The rejoicings upon the return of the king went on for several days. At the end of that time, the Ribu captives, whose singular complexion and fairness caused them to be regarded with special interest, were distributed among the special favorites of the king. Many of the girls were assigned to the queen and royal princesses, others to the wives of the priests and generals who formed the council of the king. The men were, for the most part, given to the priests for service about the temples. To his great delight, Amuba found that Jethro and himself were among the 8 captives who were assigned to the service of the priests of one of the great temples. On reaching the temple, the little band of captives were drawn up, and the high priest, Ameres, a grave and distinguished-looking man, walked along the line scrutinizing them. He beckoned to Amuba to step forward. "Henceforth," he said, "you are my servant. Behave well, and you will be well treated." He again walked down the line, and Amuba saw that he was going to choose another, and threw himself on his knees before him. "Will my lord pardon my boldness?" he said. "But may I implore you to choose yonder man who stood next beside me? He has been my friend from childhood. He covered me with his shield in battle. He has been a father to me since I have lost my own. Do not, I implore you, my lord, separate us now. You will find us both willing to labor at whatsoever you may give us to do."
The priest listened gravely. "It shall be as you wish," he said. "It is the duty of every man to give pleasure to those around him, if it lies in his power. And as your friend is a man of thews and sinews, and has a frank and honest face, he will assuredly suit me as well as another. Do you, therefore, both follow me to my house."
The other captives saluted Amuba as he and Jethro turned to follow. The priest observed the action and said to the lad,
"Were you a person of consequence among your people?"
"I am the son of he who was their king," Amuba said.
"Is it so?" the priest said. "Truly the changes and fortunes of life are strange. I wonder that being the son of their king you were not specially kept by Thotmes himself."
"I think that he knew it not," Amuba said. "We knew not your customs, and my fellow captives thought that possibly I might be put to death were it known that I was the son of their king, and therefore abstained from all outward marks of respect."
"Perhaps it is best so," the priest said thoughtfully. "You would not have been injured, for we do not slay our captives taken in war. Still, maybe your life will be easier to bear as the servant of a priest than in the household of the king. You had better, however, mention to no one the rank you have borne, for it might be reported to the king, and then you might be sent for to the palace. Unless, indeed, you would rather be a spectator of the pomp and gaiety of the court than a servant in a quiet household.
I would far rather remain with you, my lord, Amuba said eagerly. You have already shown the kindness of your heart by granting my request and choosing my comrade Jethro as my fellow slave, and I feel already that my lot will be a far happier one than I had ventured to hope.
Judge not hastily by appearances, the priest said. At the same time, here in Egypt, slaves are not treated as they are among the wild peoples of Nubia and the desert. There is a law for all, and he who kills a slave is punished as if he took the life of an Egyptian. However, I think I can say that your life will not be a hard one. You have intelligence, as is shown by the fact that you have so rapidly acquired sufficient knowledge of our tongue to speak it intelligibly. Can you, too, speak our language? He asked Jethro.
I can speak a little, Jethro said, but not nearly so well as Amuba.
You speak sufficiently well to understand, the priest said, and doubtless will in time acquire our tongue perfectly. Ah, this is my house.
The priest entered an imposing gateway, on each side of which stretched a long and lofty wall. At a distance of 50 yards from the gate stood a large dwelling. Enclosed within the walls was a space of ground which was laid out as a garden. Avenues of fruit trees ran all around it, while, separated from the rest by an avenue of palm trees, was a vegetable garden. In front of the house was a large piece of water, in which floated a gaily painted boat. Aquatic plants of all kinds bordered its edges. Graceful palms grouped their foliage over it. The broad flat leaves of lilies floated on its surface. Above them rose the white flowers which Amuba had seen carried in the religious processions and by people of the upper rank, and which he had heard were called the lotus. The two captives were struck with surprise and admiration at the beauty of the scene. A smile passed over the countenance of the priest.
Perfect happiness is for no man, he said, and yet methinks that you may in time learn at least contentment here.